Let me begin by introducing myself. My name is Tim Larson. I'm a graduate of Luther College. I have a degree in political science and economics. At Luther, we're required at the end of our term there to write a senior paper. And my paper was entitled The Arms Race and Soviet Perception. I got interested in the nuclear question through what is known as the Nuclear Concerns Group, which formed at Luther College. And we also organized a Nuclear Awareness Day when we called off all classes at Luther and held kind of teach-ins in different places across the campus, co-sponsored by professors and students. This particular session comes out of that day. I taught this particular thing at in a class on that day, and it comes from the paper that I did. When you boil the arms race down to its very basic elements, minus the probability, the statistics, the ICBMs, the throw weights, the MIRVs, all that garbage, the arms race really boils down to a mind game. I'm going to try to give you an example of something that's kind of more on a personal basis or more specific basis. Imagine for a moment that Ted and I have decided simultaneously that we are mortal enemies. Both of us carry pistols, and we get them out and point them at each other. Well, obviously, we don't trust each other's intentions, and I'm convinced that Ted wants to do me in. Okay, that presents a problem. Ted can shoot me at any opportune moment, such as when I'm eating or sleeping or just playing off my guard. I can't physically prevent Ted from shooting me at any time, but I can make myself appear stronger than Ted. And I can most easily do this by picking up, say, a shotgun with a hair trigger, or rigging a bazooka to fire at Ted with the slightest jerk of my big toe. My hope is to make Ted perceive me as stronger or more deadly than himself, using fear to make Ted think twice about ever trying any funny stuff. From then on, I can feel free and secure that Ted won't shoot me. He wouldn't dare. I'll feel happy and secure, that is, until Ted hops into his new armored tank that he just bought, at which time I'll begin shopping for my own tank. And so it goes on and on. Tanks to howitzers, howitzers to airplanes and bombs, the nuclear weapons. It's never ending. This analogy depicts a concept that's known as deterrence. Deterrence is a psychological strategy. In the illustration, my goal was to influence the way Ted thinks about me, or perceives me, or respects me. The effect, I hope, is that Ted will never attempt to shoot me. Of course, analogies have their limitations. You can twist them into making them say anything you want them to. But I think the illustration expresses the real logic behind the arms race, the tragic, almost comical situation we now find ourselves in. In the current arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union, our policy toward the further building of more and better nuclear arms is based upon how we perceive that the Soviets perceive us. Everyone has heard to a greater or lesser extent that the Reagan administration is pushing desperately to build up our military, particularly nuclear weapons. Now you may ask, what is the advantage in building better or greater quantities of nuclear weapons, when we already have the capacity to destroy every city, village, farmhouse, and town in the Soviet Union? Especially, well, we don't really want an arms race or an atomic war in the first place. The answer is quite simple, according to former Secretary of State Alexander Haig. Our nuclear capabilities affect the perceptions of our adversaries. If the Russians perceive the United States as having a stronger nuclear capacity, then they will be less apt to consider adventurism in the Third World. It will give the Reds sufficient incentive to negotiate arms control agreements. They would not dare attack the United States. And we, as a nation, can feel happy and secure. You see, the basic assumption that justifies the arms race is pretty simple. The Soviet Union must be an enemy of the United States in order to have an arms race. The administration perceives the Soviets as inherently aggressive and expansionistic. Reagan believes that the Soviets want to dominate the world, and a lot of people do. Also, they are our main competition in the world for influence and also in controlling markets. Our policy directed at the Soviet Union assumes that the Soviets are the bad guys. Remember that before Ted and I got started in our little arms race, we first became mortal enemies. You see, we no longer have to bother updating our perceptions of Soviet goals or intentions. Our main goal now is to deter them from destroying us. As paranoia sets in, the one-to-one relationship we have with the Russian people is no longer important. You see, because the Soviet people have become death count statistics in simulated nuclear war games designed by the Pentagon. So what are the consequences, anyway? His name is Stossinger, an authority on war and international perception, reminds us that the stage of world politics lends itself all too easily to the development of wide gaps between what reality is and how it's perceived. Because of this fact, perception probably plays almost an important role in international realities as objective reality itself. With the advent of nuclear weapons over the past 30 years, the tremendous development and production of better and more numerous strategic missile systems by both the United States and the Soviet Union, even a minor misperception or calculation could in a short time lead to a nuclear holocaust of unimaginable destruction. Stossinger warns, if one believes a stereotype long enough, it may become reality by setting in motion a mechanism of self-fulfilling prophecy. Thus, if a nation believes that the other is its implacable enemy and reiterates it often enough, making it the guidelines of its national policy, it will eventually be right. I believe that such a situation exists in the current Soviet-American relations, and it's basically increasing the likelihood of a general nuclear conflict. One thing I think is certain in the arms race. The Soviet Union will never allow the United States an advantage in terms of nuclear weapons again. Ever. And I think there are a lot of reasons for this. First of all, the Soviet sense of world mission, the insecurity of Soviet leaders, the Soviet need for world prestige, the influence of the Soviet military on Soviet policy decisions, and Russian pride and nationalism. The first thing I want to start out with is how Soviet ideology, or Marxist-Leninism, affects the arms race. This is maybe a little complicated, but bear with me. The Soviets need a nuclear parity or superiority with the United States in order to project their influence in the world. It is the Soviets' sense of world mission which is derived from their Marxist-Leninist ideology, which will not allow them to fall behind the United States in terms of nuclear weapons. Marx's theory depicts a historically continuous violent class struggle between two economic classes, the exploited proletariat and the capital-controlling bourgeoisie. Marx saw that conflict between the two classes going on within a country. For instance, that's how the Russian Revolution took place. It was something that happened within the country. After the revolution, though, Lenin had to translate this conflict onto a world level. When the revolution did not develop in all capitalist countries, as Marx had predicted, Lenin had to contend that the capitalists had somehow been able to buy off their respective the proletariat in their respective countries by exploiting people in other less developed countries. The class struggle that Marx saw going on within countries, Lenin saw going on between countries. When the historical conditions are right, therefore, the Soviets believe that the exploited people of the world will indeed unite and throw off their chains. There exists a sense of mission, a faith that history is on their side. It is this dogmatic view of history that has given rise to a belief in a kind of Russian manifest destiny, in our way, kind of analogous to the way we look at our West, which we conquered. They see themselves as leaders of an international movement, which in their eyes will point the world away from exploitative capitalism into the sunshine of Marxist-Leninism. Nuclear parity or superiority with the United States is important to them because a nuclear imbalance relative to the United States might negate the inevitable decline of Western fortunes. There is no time limit in the Russian opinion, no time limit as to the eventual ascendancy of communism in the world to the Soviets. Socialism will dominate when the historical conditions are right in the world. Therefore, their mission they view as timeless. The Soviets don't feel their goal must be reached at any given time. The main thing is that there always should be constant, unceasing pressure toward their goal. Nuclear weapons, they're acquiring nuclear weapons and holding them is a means to apply such pressure. It is unlikely that this nuclear pressure will cease, their nuclear pressure will cease, after the 5-year intensive rearmament program by the United States. I believe it, what is it, Mary? $1.2 trillion? It's just incredible. The Russians will simply build to keep up, if they can. See, the real irony is that in their view, nuclear bombs deter the United States from expanding our interests in the world. It's the Russian sense of historical mission that is the very root between the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. From the antagonism between the two countries' economic systems flows many of the phenomena which the United States government finds disturbing in the Kremlin's conduct of foreign policy. The secretiveness, the lack of frankness, the duplicity, the wary suspiciousness, and the unfriendliness of purpose. The Russians, in turn, view the United States as inherently exploitive and expansionistic in purpose. The current situation regarding the buildup of nuclear weapons on both sides is a result of a cyclical relationship, which gathers momentum as each country perceives the other's ideological intentions as dangerous. Thus, the Soviet ideology is reinforced by their view of our exploitation. They, in turn, project a sense of challenge to us. We respond to this threat through our own mechanisms, building more bombs, which causes the Soviets to reinforce their mechanisms, and so forth. Suspicion begets suspicion. Military buildup begets military buildup. Two highly technical superpowers slide into an uncontrollable spiral of aggressiveness and fear. And this slide is particularly uncontrollable if the principles Soviet Union and the United States are dealing in stereotype perceptions of one another. Soviets' need for prestige in the world also affects the arms race. In some ways, the United States has recognized the Soviets as an equal power. We recognize the Soviets in the form of a détente, in a way, when we did that, in a way, we were recognizing them as an equal within the world. The same thing could apply to our willingness to negotiate arms control agreements like SALT I or SALT II. We had to recognize them as an equal in order for ourselves to justify any kind of arms agreements with them. The Soviets need this recognition in order to carry on their moral historical mission. It was the Soviet military buildup that legitimized their claim to be a world power. This tremendously enhances Soviet prestige in the Third World. Third World leaders have a tendency to look at the rise of Soviet nuclear capacities as an indication of Soviet ascendancy relative to the United States. Third World nations tend to align themselves accordingly. Yet nuclear weapons themselves do not afford the necessary conditions for the Soviets to project their influence in the world. It's more indirect. A Third World country must be ripe for revolt in order for them to truly project their influence. The Reagan administration contends that the Soviets use their power as blackmail in the Third World and blackmail them into joining their moral historical mission. I suspect, however, that the Soviets realize that dropping a bomb on a developing country won't leave too terribly many people left to convert. To many, Afghanistan gives credibility to the theory that the Russians are reincarnated Hitlers, that they're bent on domination of the world at any cost, including the use of atomic bombs to attain their goal. This is called a worst-case theory. It's often used to justify, well, it's not only the Reagan administration, but administrations all the way from 1945 to modernize our military forces. Yet the Soviets can easily justify its arsenals of atomic weapons by claiming that they need to defend the Soviet Union from invasion by the West. There is no doubt that the Soviet leaders have a right to feel insecure. The Soviets have indeed been invaded three times this century, two times in World War I, and twice and once in World War II. That's in the last 80 years. And along with that, many Americans are unaware that the United States occupied Soviet soil at the end of World War I. When the Russian Revolution occurred and Russia pulled out of World War I, we swept in and occupied territory in the Ukraine, in Murmansk, and also in Vladivostok on the east coast of Russia. And they remember that. They we kind of think of it as a footnote, you know, how many countries have we been in over the years? But it shows up in all their history books. They teach their children that the United States once invaded them, whether that's too strong a word or not. The Soviets have equal reason to fear that they may be attacked by nuclear weapons. If you put yourself in their position, the Soviet Union is virtually surrounded by nuclear powers. There is England and France who have nuclear weapons in Western Europe. There's India in the south, and China in the southeast. And of course the United States, if we fired our nuclear weapons at the Soviet Union, they would approach from over the North Pole, so they'd be approaching from the north. China is a particular problem for the Soviets. They've had an ongoing border dispute with the Chinese for years, hundreds of years. China, of course, has a population of 1 billion people, and in these last few years has become increasingly friendly with their enemy, the United States, and that worries them. I guess you can, if you put yourself in the Soviet leader's shoes, you can imagine this situation by picturing 1 billion Mexicans with nuclear weapons claiming the southern half of California, all of Arizona, all of New Mexico and Texas, hating Americans and allied with Russia. We'd be paranoid too. The nuclear weapons assure the Soviets that they will never be invaded again. If anyone ever dared to invade the Soviet Union, all they'd have to do is bomb their country, wipe out their capitals, bomb their troops. It's probable that part of the reason the Soviets have continued to build weapons is because the Russians feel insecure. Any step for them to enhance their own security is really pretty easy for them to justify in their own minds. It's easy for them to justify the building of arms, nuclear arms, if their enemy is also building. The Soviet military, the military establishment, also contributes to the arms race. The Soviet military hardliners strongly believe the United States has plans for crushing socialism. Therefore, the Soviet Union must be ready to fight a war instigated by the imperialists, and they feel end in victory. They simply do not trust the United States government. As the Reagan administration enacts its plan to modernize our nuclear arsenals, one can expect the Soviets to do the same. The Soviet military hardliners are just as adamant as any hardliners we have in this country, as any hawks that we have. But remember, though, they need no congressional approval to get what they want. All they need is proof that the imperialists are behaving aggressively, and they can go ahead and do it. It's also important to remember that the Soviet military bureaucracy is no different than any other bureaucracy. Building weapons and waging war is their livelihood. This gives the military an incentive to push for increased spending in nuclear arms. In my opinion, the United States can expect the Soviet military establishment to perceive a United States strategic modernization as an aggressive act, and they're going to react accordingly. Now, there are people in the United States that believe, so what? So what to what you're saying? By escalating the arms race, that will indeed be beneficial. This view is based upon what is known as the bleed them to death theory. Since the American economy is much larger than the Soviets, our economy is about 2.6 trillion GNP, gross national product, to their 1.4, about twice as large. These people believe the United States can therefore spend the Soviets into economic collapse, and that we would thus win the arms race. Then everyone will feel happy and secure, right? Well, I suspect there are three good arguments against such policy. The Soviet government has the ability to squeeze additional resources from its own citizens to meet the challenge of an escalating arms race. They're a totalitarian regime. They have that kind of power. Stalin, of course, is the most recent example. They can simply muscle a greater percentage of their gross national product for defense. The Soviet citizens, the Russian people, have a tremendous capacity to tolerate oppression. I've heard that if they have to, they can endure 5 meatless days a week for the Communist Party. And I gotta wonder if the United States, if we ever got to that kind of a situation, could ever match that kind of commitment to an arms race. Would you be willing to give up meat 5 days a week so that we can build nuclear arms? Well, despite the oppression, the Soviet people have a very deep and tenacious love of their country. It is their land. They've lived there, well, for generations, you know, dating back to 900. People have lived there.
Is it love for country? Love the country, or is it always based on xenophobia kind of thing, you know, fearing the outsider and always finding themselves against other people so strongly?
Okay, I guess what I'm trying to say is that they have a deep love for their land, just like we love Washington State for its mountains and its valleys, and love Colorado for the mountains and California for the coastline and that kind of thing. They love the beauty of the Russian country.
And we don't?
Well, sure we do. Sure we do. But I'm just saying they do too. They call their land Mother Russia. Heinrich Smith, he's a journalist who spent a great deal of time in the Soviet Union, wrote a book called The Russians. It's in the library. He stated that without question, a deep and tenacious love of country is the most powerful unifying force in the Soviet Union. In World War II, it was a profound sense of nationalism that they were being invaded that rallied the Russian people. And it wasn't against the Nazis. It wasn't the Marxist-Leninist ideology. In fact, at that time, Stalin relaxed a lot of the constraints he had put on the Orthodox Church in Russia. And the Orthodox Church became a motivating force in rallying the people against the Nazis. I think the same would be true if the Russian people could be convinced that a nuclear arms race sped up or escalated by the United States is a threat to their homeland. Would justify that kind of thing. Anyway, thirdly, for the sake of argument, let's pretend that, or suppose that the United States won such a race, that we spent the Russians into economic collapse, caused chaos and whatever. All I can do is answer it with a question. Would a world with a defeated and vengeful superpower possessing thousands of nuclear weapons and an attitude like, "Hey, we got nothing to lose," really be a safe place to live? I'll let you decide. There's no easy solutions to this dilemma. The other day I was talking to Tad, and it occurred to me that, well, after all the time I've spent with working on the reason behind the arms race, the logic, the assumptions, and all those things, hoping to find some kind of alternatives, I realized that there really isn't any until we can deal with that very basic assumption that the Soviet Union is our enemy. There is a nuclear freeze campaign going on right now. And in the phrase campaign, the idea is to push for both nations to stop producing nuclear weapons wherever they are. Doesn't matter who's ahead or what. Just stop so that the spiral won't continue. And I think that if that is ever to come about, then we need to realize that empathy is the solution. We need to put our own feet in the Russian shoes and see the world as they do. Now, I'm not saying that we should be sympathetic to the Russians necessarily, but empathetic. I had a professor at Luther. His name's Bruce Reitzman, and Bruce would go to the Soviet Union all the time. It's kind of funny. Bruce is because he goes so often, he's suspected by the KGB of smuggling Bibles into the country. But he's in a squeeze because the CIA thinks he's a communist. Well, anyway, what Bruce suggests is that we start a huge, massive exchange program between the United States and the Soviet Union. Fly Americans over the Soviet Union. Fly Soviets over the United States so that we can get to know the Russian people. And I'm using Russian loosely because, of course, there are all kinds of different countries in the Soviet Union. But to get us to realize the humanness that's involved. What's his name? Kohan? We were talking about that. He said he's really he's really happy when he can play his flute in Eastern European countries in the Soviet Union, because he says, without saying anything about the arms race or anything about politics, he's shown his audience that there are Americans who are human beings. And I think that's important.
But so, you just said a while back that it doesn't matter what the people think because they're under the power of the leaders and they have to accept whatever the leaders say.
Yeah.
I'm all for making friends with the Russians.
Well, I think we all are. That is a true dilemma. How do you deal with a closed society? I just like Jeff's answer. Anyway, Jim, being the poet he is and appreciator of poems, I thought I'd close with this. He gave me a poem by John Updike, written in 1965. It's called A Poem for a Far Land. It goes like this. Russia, most feminine of lands, breeder of stupid masculinity. Only Jesus understands your interminable virginity. Raped and raped and raped again, you rise snow white, the utter same, with tender birches and ox-eyed men willing to suffer for your fair name. Though astronauts distress the sky that mothers your low, sad villages, your vastness yearns in sympathy between what was and that which is. So all I'm going to do, I've never been to the Soviet Union. I've never been in the country. All I know is what I've read and the people I've interviewed who've been there. So what I'm going to do is open up the discussion and let you talk about it a little bit. Well, what are your feelings?
First, I think you did a really good job.
It's not an unanswerable thing in the Call to Conversion book. James Wallace talked about the security or the authority of any system is threatened very much by people, a growing minority of people who do not believe in the ultimate authority of that system. And if more and more people in Russia hear American flutes or more pen pals are made across the sea, and we can do something anyway to increase the minority and let it grow of the country's people who love the other people and make it known that they don't think of the other people as enemies and begin to put pressure on the government. And I think there's something that can be said for that.
Yeah, I sure do too. Go ahead, Roxy.
Is that then to say that we really will then put pressure on our own governments to make them cease the arms race?
Well, the unfortunate reality is that we can influence our government, and we can put a heck of a lot of pressure on Ronald Reagan to negotiate for a nuclear freeze, for instance. We can't do that in terms of the Soviet Union. They're a closed society.
They've already said that they would if we did.
Well, do you trust your enemy?
I trust the Russians. I trust him every single minute. I trust him not to push the button, and they trust us not to push it.
That's a good point.
It's been going on a long time.
That's right, Bill.
Do you think that it would be in their best interest not to continue the escalation, but that each side might have a sufficient amount now to prevent the other from jumping?
Oh, sure. They've got all kinds of incentives to stop the arms race. The bleed them to death theory does work in a lot of ways. I mean, they really, if they had to, they could come up with the resources to build more arms. But it does work in the sense that there's a tremendous amount of strain on their economy right now because they are building weapons. And they have to face every day the issue of guns versus butter.
What I'm trying to say then is it doesn't look as if we would need to put that much pressure on them for something which is in their own best interest that they're intelligent enough to realize, if it can be worked out so that they can trust us and we can verify that they're doing what they say they're doing.
Well, I don't know if you've heard very much about this stuff or not, but verification is the big stumbling block between any arms control agreements or anything else. And I know Bill stuck that in. We have the capacity now, we have spy satellites that are so sensitive that they can take a very clear picture of this cup if it's sitting out in the road. It's that sensitive. And as far as verifying, we have the means now to verify any kinds of treaties we have.
I didn't think that was the main problem. I thought the main problem was figuring out what was fair to us and what was fair to them, and that each country is only agreeing to what's advantageous for themselves.
Well, that's what Ronald Reagan would contend. You see, Tom, you know as well as I do that we've gone well beyond the means of holding weapons enough to destroy the Soviet Union. We've got, the Soviet Union, for instance, has 6,000 strategic nuclear missiles with a firepower of about 11,500 megatons. That's about 920,000 Hiroshima bombs. I mean, come on.
Okay, but why aren't the talks centered around the verification rather than the imbalance that we keep hearing about,
because the arms race is a psychological reasoning strategy type thing. It's what I'm trying to say is that kind of thinking doesn't even come into question. It's not a matter whether we have enough bombs to destroy the Soviets or they have enough bombs to destroy us. It's a matter of making them perceive that we're stronger than they are, or they make us perceive that they're stronger than we are.
Yeah.
See, it's the logic of the arms race that makes them count missiles.
And facts have nothing to do with it.
That's right.
Okay, I understand that, but I don't see how verification fits into that then.
Well, basically, I think it's an excuse by the Reagan administration not to sign any arms control treaties.
Well, don't you think that, am I overstating to say the military-industrial complex is just scared? I mean, if the arms race stops, it's going to be a mess for thousands and thousands of people that are reaping the profits. Am I overstating that?
No, I don't think you're overstating it at all.
Yeah, I think if there was a real threat of world peace breaking out and taking over the economy of the Bay Area, San Francisco, they'd be threatened. And yet I talked to an engineer who worked for a military complex in that area, San Francisco, San Jose Bay Area. He says they could convert to peacetime kind of stuff in a matter of months, not years, but they're talking months. But there would be that fear by the military complex, I agree.
But when huge corporations have been interviewed, according to Jack Nelson in his book, about switching to peacetime operations, they don't like to hear that because they reap 17.6% return on the investment with government military stuff as compared to 10.6% with just general commercial stuff.
Yeah.
So it's much more profitable for the stockholders and large corporations to be dealing with military stuff.
When you deal with the government economically, you're dealing with a guaranteed profit. Absolutely guaranteed. If you have a cost overrun on your project, you're still guaranteed a profit.
Sure, and they all do have cost overruns.
Sure, I mean, it's the safest business. If you're looking for security in business, it's great.
Is there any kind of existing peace movement within the Soviet Union that you know of?
Yeah.
Is it squashed immediately? What is, are people being martyrs for the peace movement over there? What's going on, do you know?
Dan, I think you'd know.
Yeah, there's a peace group that has made the news the last couple of months. Very prominent people in the Soviet Union, but they're being squashed very systematically now.
Yeah, but Pom's going to the USSR in June to talk with peace group, young people who are into peace issues. There must be, within the churches, a strong...
Well, it depends on what your perception of them is.
Yeah.
If you are a military hardliner, you can say those people are being duped. Tom Witt is being duped by the communists. Because all they're doing is setting up a peace group that is designed to make Tom Witt think that there's a peace group in the Soviet Union. So that we will let down our guard and therefore they can wipe us out.
Why David Price went to Russia to that peace conference and James Crumley didn't because the LCA people convinced him he'd be a duke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when David Price was in Poland speaking with the Prime Minister, he questioned the Prime Minister on the growing peace movement among the youth, especially. He said the Prime Minister slammed his fist down and said, the party is the peace movement.
Yeah.
And is that the kind of thinking that by the leaders? I don't know. I feel really unknowledgeable.
Well, that's what they squelched in the Soviet Union. That was the group that tried to start a peace movement. It was not the official government peace movement. So.
At the World Council of Churches Conference on Faith, Science, and the Future in 1979, Russian Orthodox Church of the Soviet Union was well represented by people who spoke, as did everyone who addressed the issue at that conference, of the need for reversing the arms race. They said that they have, of course, no power within the Soviet Union, and yet they were there at the pleasure of the government of the Soviet Union. And would certainly not be saying something that would be getting them into great trouble at home. Now, again, you might say they were trying to dupe the rest of the world, but they were certainly speaking as advocates of reducing the
numbers.
Second, there was an international meeting of physicians held, I think, in London in the last year. And among the speakers there was one whose high positions in the Soviet Union included being Brezhnev's personal physician, who was saying that there is the same thing that the physicians for social responsibility say in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There is no possibility, period, of anyone winning a nuclear war. There is no way of protecting a population against nuclear war.
Yep.
The whole thing with the peace movement in the Soviet Union seems irrelevant to me, though. I mean, it seems like the Soviet government wanted to foster a peace movement within the churches in the Soviet Union. It's not going to have any impact on them, but it's going to, you know, have a good show to people outside of the Soviet Union. I don't see any problem there. They're going to shut down the people who are condemning the Soviet Union, but for the most part, they're as well informed as the peace movement is in the United States as far as knowing the United States is ahead technologically of the Soviet Union in the nuclear arms race. So, you know, they're more than willing, I think, to have people speak out against that.
Sure. Hey, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to be space wars. pretty soon. They're gonna have space battleships pretty soon. Satellites hovering over the United States that with laser beams that will knock out approaching missiles as they come before they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere.
Luke, cut off your computer.
Justify, I think, one reality. Here's our reality. That is real. We had a man in our church in Albuquerque who was working on weaponry for 20 years now, and claimed the reason he was doing it because the Soviets were ahead.
Well, you see that. Okay.
But I was going to say something else, but go ahead.
Well, that's all right. I can withhold it, I think.
Okay.
I don't know.
I was going back to this having home exchanges with the Soviets. I think anything we do to show friendship to the Soviet Union, the powers, whatever that is, going to interpret that as we're dupes of the Soviet Union, and they want us to be friendly, so that will lower our guard so they can take over the world.
Let's think about that for a second. Why would the Soviet Union want to take over the world? Like Bob and I talked about. Yeah, why would they want to take over the... I mean, why would they want to destroy the United States?
I heard Gene Marat comment on that. Someone asked him, don't the Soviets want to take over the world? He says, yes, I believe they do, just as much as the U.S. does. I mean, we want people to think like we do.
That, I think, is the key, that we want people to think like we do. And the Soviets want people who think like they do. But the Russians can't take over the world. They only have 250 million people in their country. I mean, if the army came over here and invaded our country, how would they ever keep down the oppressed people at home?
How would they run
Peoria? You're in New Jersey.
Yeah.
I had a friend and famous teacher in Minnesota named Alfred Sibley, and he said that when nations hate each other, the first thing they do is exchange vices. And so some years ago, a clever British reporter was in Khrushchev's office and noticed the only thing visible there was a picture of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln stands for both people all around the world as a great liberator of the oppressed. And then the same reporter went into John Foster Dulles' office, as Secretary of State when Eisenhower was there, and there he saw the collected works of Vladimir Lenin. The point is, and he said to him, why do you have these here? He says, this gives me the clue as to Soviet behavior. Well, I don't want to belabor this too much, but sometimes we really are caught in a trance. As Emily remarks in her work as a psychologist, that when we hate and fear a human being because they are a distorted mirror of our own tendencies, and when we accuse the Soviets of taking over the world, that is certainly one of our secret desires, and the reverse is true also.
I think that's true. Yeah,
at some point along the way when we were talking about trust, and I was reminded of when I'd seen the film earlier last fall about the people at Climate Defense of Triton and why they did it and so on. And it just strikes me that I think I really do trust our government even less than I did 20 years ago, because now I know some of the lies that I've been told by people in office. And I can't see that it's much different than the kind of lies that the Russians tell their people too, you know. And so it's us that I don't trust. And we've already used those nuclear weapons twice on people, you know. I mean, we didn't just spook them, we plastered them with it. And I have no reason to believe that we're in any better condition now mentally or any other way that we wouldn't do it again. It's kind of a despair situation in that regard, but on the other hand, we've managed to not do it for a long time. I've heard people older than I am say, we would never do that. Just like that, forgetting completely that we already did it, and twice.
Roxy, my ultimate pessimism is to some extent this. We wouldn't have done it if the Japanese could have retaliated with a nuke. Just as the British wouldn't have marched down to Argentina if Argentina had the nukes.
Yeah, but we did a first strike thing.
Yes, you made a point that so many Americans forget. We were the first to use the nukes, and we used them twice. We're the only people in the world who've used them against anybody else.
Right.
In some respects, that's a more important fact than our little invasion of Russia.
Well, yeah,
I think that keeping half a dozen of them floating around in subs in the ocean ought to be enough, because they know we'll use them.
But that is the only, but I just want to interject this, that is the only time we have ever fought against the Russians. In every other war, we fought on their side. We fought on their side in the World War II. They were allies.
Yes.
But also in World War II, when I was over there, when I was in the Soviet Union, they have memorials all over the place because we forget that they lost 20 million people in World War II.
20 million.
And you walk around the streets, and there aren't any old men.
Yep.
There are none. They're all killed in the war. That's just a common knowledge, common fact.
You see, and something to remember about nuclear war is the fact that the whole nature of war has changed. Once you have, in 30 minutes, more people could die in 30 minutes than in the 5 years it took to fight World War II.
Yeah.
In 30 minutes. Yeah. Okay.
People that say we have to keep the world safe from godless communism, the more I think about that statement, that is so stupid. It's like saying that God is not powerful enough, to overcome even godlessness. The word of God is never going to be stamped out. The kingdom of God is never going to be secured. Luther, is he in the mighty fortress who would take they then our goods, fame, child, wife, spouse, or they their worst of them, and yet have nothing won the kingdom of earth.
Well, Mary, that's great. You see, we have a godless country. If you think about it, our ideology of democracy or whatever is godless, but we call it a different word. We call it secular. We don't call it godless. We call it secular. I just want to throw this in, and I guess we got a few minutes here. This is I thought this was just a great comment because you could invert it so well. This comes out of a book of nuclear strategic planning strategies and something else. It was about that thick, and the reading was really slow. But anyway, this is a Soviet general talking about nuclear war. It says, a future war, if the imperialists, and we'll parenthesize the communists, succeed in unleashing it, will be an armed clash between two opposed social systems. The probability of any sort of compromise between them will be excluded, since the struggle will acquire an extremely acute class character, or will be a battle between totalitarianism and democracy. And this will give battle action exceptional decisiveness. This will become apparent in the striving to win and hold fire superiority over the enemy, and also in energetic, boldness, and selfless actions of the troops following nuclear strikes for the purpose of completing the defeat of the enemy in a short period of time and achieving victory. How much does that sound like the kind of war we fought in World War II? If you think about it, they think that war hasn't changed at all. They've just got bigger bombs now, bigger bangs. And I could picture that statement coming out of somebody from the Pentagon just as easily as I could hear it from the Kremlin. It's a mentality that is stuck in both countries.
Well, as Einstein said, everything has changed except our way of thinking. We've got to change our way of thinking, ours and theirs, somehow.
There's another form of traditionalism that I've often mentioned in these debates here and other places. It's a great French sociologist, Raymond Aron, who said in 1946, the nuclear shield releases the conventional sword. My own view is that the U.S. and Russia in my lifetime, and perhaps yours, are not going to exchange the nukes. But the American and Russian nuclear shield allows the conventional sword to be used here, there, and everywhere. And the Swedes have conducted statistics on deaths since 1945. They are something around 20 million, the number of Russians that Paul mentioned. Mm-hmm. And those are, as you know, Vietnam, Korea, Bangladesh, and other places. I'm not one of these people that makes the United States the victim. The Soviet Union and America are just about equal in furnishing the conventional sword. This is the pattern for a long time to come. So this thing that you read, I agree, it's naive in a way, and yet battle after battle, so-called conventional forces will be fought again and again and again. And my view is that nukes will not be used.
Yeah, but you see, he says the nukes will be used. And he says that they're going to run troops into the nukes.
They will remain the, as Dan said, as a joke the other day about the Canaanites. They are kind of a insurance policy for good crops. They're a form of insurance policy which you don't cash in on.
Yeah, but Chekhov, can I quote
him?
You never hang a weapon on the wall in the first act and not use it by the third act.
Yeah.
Okay. Yay. Just might as well close up here. We've
that's
got a.
Urgent, Mary.
But one last thought. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has a clock on their magazine every time they publish it. It's minutes to midnight, supposedly, how close we are to a nuclear exchange. And steadily over the past few years, the minute hand has been coming closer and closer to midnight. It was 8 minutes and then five. I believe right now it's at 3 minutes.
Four minutes.
Something like that. Anyway, one thing you can think about when we're talking about nuclear weapons, even if we could get a nuclear freeze, so to speak, that clock, the minute hand, will only move back a few minutes, maybe to five, maybe to six. And let's say that we could disarm our world of nuclear weapons. Well, that's still only going to move that minute hand back. Because the technology, the knowledge, is still there to build nuclear weapons. We can simply, we just rebuild our arsenals, right? And even if somehow we could destroy all of the books and we could eliminate all of the physicists who know anything about nuclear technologies, it still only moves the hand of the clock back, because the knowledge is still there to be obtained and redeveloped.
We have to change our way
and
of
reuse.
Thinking.
That's the point. So we're going to have to learn to live with nukes. It's sad but true.
A man falls off a 20-story building as he goes by the 10th floor and he says, "So far, so good."
Oh, Jim.
That's how I quit sometimes.
For sure.